Hola a todos, bienvenidos a un nuevo episodio de Pieles. ¿Cómo están todos? Para todos los que nos están viendo, los que nos están escuchando, la verdad que este episodio para mí es un enorme placer, es un enorme kavod, de honor, como decimos en hebreo, poder presentar a mi moré, a mi profesor, a mi rabino, el rabino David Golinkin. Vamos a ver otro episodio en inglés, que también vamos a poder ver los subtítulos aquí, luego que alguien generosamente lo va a traducir. Pero quería presentarles a quien hoy en día es una de las grandes autorías de Alajá en el movimiento conservador y una de las grandes luminarias en el desarrollo del Alajá de la ley judía. Así que ese va a ser el tema de nuestro podcast, el desarrollo del Alajá en los últimos 3.000 años de la historia de nuestro pueblo. Rabbi David Golinkin, welcome.
Mucho gusto. Buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes, buenos días.
Shalom de Jerusalén.
Muy bien, muy bien. Ok. Let's do it in English, if it's okay with you.
Okay, no problem.
Okay. So, Rav, just tell us in a couple of minutes, okay, because I know you, many people know you, and I admire you, I studied with you, I read all the papers, all the teshubot, all the responsa that you frequently write. I ask you questions about Jewish law or about books, okay, because you love books. Okay, many times I ask you many questions, where I can find this or where, okay, and you give me an answer in a couple of minutes, so I'm very thankful for that, but many people do not know you. So who is David Golinkin?
Okay, I'm a conservative Masorti rabbi. I've been living in Jerusalem mostly for the past many years. I made Aliyah in 1972 after high school. I was ordained as a rabbi by JTS in New York because at that time, Machon Schechter did not exist. I started teaching in this building that I'm sitting in Machon Schechter in 1982. I taught rabbinical students who spent a year here from JTS. I taught rabbinical students who spent a year here from the Seminario Rabbinico. And beginning in the late 1980s, I've been teaching Israeli rabbinical students and master students at Machon Schechter at the Schechter Institute. We have an Israeli rabbinical school, which is called the Schechter Rabbinical Seminary, where the seminario students come to study for a year, usually. And the students, such as Rabbi Uriel Romano. And we have the students from JTS in New York who come to study here for a year. And that's in the rabbinical school. And in addition, we run a graduate school, a master's program, which has 400 students who are mostly Israeli teachers, principals, and communal workers who are going back to school after many years of working out in the field. They're usually in their 40s, and they come and do a master's degree here at Schechter over the course of 2 or 3 or 4 years. They come in one day a week to study. And I teach the rabbinical students and the master's students Talmud. I teach them halacha from one of the standard books of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch. I teach them responsa, which are shelot to tshuvot, questions and answers that people ask rabbis and rabbis give answers to. And I also teach Pirkei Avot, the ethics of the fathers, and Midrash. In other words, all the different areas of rabbinic literature. In addition, since 1990, I've been one of the leaders of the Schechter Institutes. At various points in time, I was the dean of the graduate school, the dean of the rabbinical school, the president of the graduate school. And since 2015, I've been the president of the Schechter Institutes Incorporated, which is the organization that raises money for all of the various projects that we do here in the state of Israel, which include the rabbinical school, the graduate school, the Tali school system, which is 65,000 children studying in Israeli public schools, which have the Tali program, a special Jewish studies program that we have developed over the past 40 years. And we have a branch in Tel Aviv called Neve Schechter, which is an outreach center for people who live in Tel Aviv with an emphasis on Jewish music and art. And we have a school system / synagogue network in the Ukraine, which is called Midreshet Yerushalayim, which we have been running for the past 30 years. So those are the things that Schechter does. And I mentioned my teaching and my fundraising. The last thing I will say is that in my quote, spare time, I write tshuvot, I write responsa. People send me questions from all over the world and I try to answer them. I've written some 900 responsa.
900?
Yes. Wow. They fill up two drawers here. Some of us still write. And I've published about 200 of them, some of them in English, some of them in Hebrew, and some in both languages. And at least 30, 40 of them were translated into Spanish by, what was her name? Okrit, Zichrona Libracha.
And from Uruguay, right? From Uruguay.
Right, from Uruguay. She passed away, but Rabbi Ariel Segal has them somewhere on a computer if you want to find them in Spanish. But in general, you can find my responsa in English.
So you have at least 700 more to publish, okay? So you have a lot of work right. to do because we want
so
to read
them.
So
in English, you can find 160 some responsa on the Schechter Institute website. In Hebrew, you can find a smaller number on the Machon Schechter website in Hebrew. And we have a third website that calls that is called responsafortoday.com. And there you have quite a few tshuvot of mine in Hebrew and also summaries in English. So that in a nutshell is what I've been doing for the past 40 years.
And it's just amazing. And it's just amazing. So let's dive into the subject of today, the history and development of Halakha. And Rabbi, let's do this kind of conversation with your knowledge, because people who study with you, you are like an open book. Okay, how many books do you have? Do you have any idea,
Rabbi? I don't know. I once tried to count the books here in my office. I think that there were 12,000. I have a few thousand more at home. But if you look behind me, you only see the front row of each shelf. Many of the shelves
like
have two rows of books. And I can find you a book with the... I can find you a book with the lights out. I know where all the books are. So yes, I have a lot of books.
Studying over there, let me tell you, because he's in the office where we all study. It's a small office, okay, with a couple of, 10 chairs and a table in between and books surrounding you. It's just the atmosphere is just amazing. So let's dive into the book, because you love books, you love history, you love the halakha, and you're a very serious teacher, okay, of halakha. Let's start with this question. Okay, usually people, or at least some part of the Orthodox world or some part Jewry, says the halakha, the voice of law, the law of God, never changed.
Right.
It has been like that because God does not change, so his law doesn't change. Let's start with that very small question.
Right. What can I say? People who say that for ideological reasons. Orthodoxy is something that developed during the past 200 years. It started with the Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, who died in 1839, but it really started around 1810. And it started as a reaction to the Reform Movement. The Reform Movement was a radical movement originally, which grew up in Germany, starting in 1810. And the Reform Movement wanted to change everything. They wanted to move Shabbat to Sunday. They wanted to put the organ in the synagogue. They wanted to give the sermons in German instead of in Hebrew or Yiddish. They wanted to abolish Brit Milah, circumcision, and so on and so forth. So that was a new way of dealing with modernity. The reaction of the Orthodox was they want to change everything. We will say that all change is forbidden. And the rabbis who say that change is forbidden are not making a factual statement, they're making an ideological statement. In other words, they are arguing with the Reform who say you can change everything. From a factual point of view, to say the Jewish law has never changed is just silly. Most of the things we do today as Jews did not exist in the biblical period. Many of the things we do today as Jews did not exist in the Talmudic period. The word for Jewish law is halakha. Halakha comes from the verb halach, to go. Halakha holechet, the halakha goes, it's constantly walking, it's constantly in motion. And that is the beauty of any legal system, but certainly the beauty of the Jewish legal system. And the easiest way I can show you this graphically, since I like books, is here I'm holding in my hand a Tanakh. Okay, so this is Torah Nevi'im Ktuvim, Torah, the prophets and the writings. This takes us from the time of Avraham Avinu, let's say 1800 before the Common Era, until the time of Ezra Nehemiah in the 5th century before the Common Era. That is the written Torah and the prophets and the writings. The next stage in the development of Jewish law is the Mishnah. This is the Albic edition of the Mishnah. There are 6 volumes of the Mishnah. The Mishnah was edited by Rabbi Yehuda Nasi around the year 200 of the Common Era. In other words, about 650 years after the end of the Tanakh, you have the Mishnah. And the Mishnah is called frequently the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, because its teachings were transmitted orally for hundreds of years before they were written down. And believe it or not, the rabbis in the time of the Mishnah knew 6 volumes of this. They knew it by heart, not just the rabbis. The many, many Jews knew the entire Mishnah by heart. A number of years ago, as part of my course of teaching Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, I decided to memorize Pirkei Avot, which I now recite by heart once a week, because I wanted to understand what it means, Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. If you can learn one tractate of the Mishnah by heart, you can also learn the entire Mishnah by heart if you wish to do so. I don't wish to do so. I'm rather busy. However, this was transmitted for hundreds of years until it was written down at some time, let's say in the 3rd century. The next stage in the development of Jewish law was the Babylonian Talmud. This is one of 20 volumes. This is the tractate of Brachot. The Babylonian Talmud is the discussions and comments of the Amoraim, of the rabbis of the Talmud, on the Mishnah, organized according to the order of the tractates of the Mishnah, right? So this book has tractate Brachot of the Mishnah, and this book has tractate Brachot of the Babylonian Talmud, which is a few hundred years later, let's say in the 5th century. It contains the discussions and explanations of the Mishnah by the rabbis of Bavel and Eretz Yisrael on the tractate of Brachot. And I happen to be now teaching the tractate of Brachot at our conservative synagogue in Jerusalem every Shabbat afternoon for the past 20 years. Every Shabbat afternoon, I teach a class in Talmud or Midrash. And we're now on Daf Mem Gimel, folio 43. And we're slowly learning through Masechet Brachot of the Babylonian Talmud. The next stage in the development of Jewish law was the Rambam. This happens to be one of the editions of the Rambam in 20 volumes, Rambam La'am. Rabbi Moshe ben Naimon, one of the greatest geniuses in all of Jewish history, perhaps in human history. he lived from 1135 to 1204, mostly in Egypt. And he decided to codify all of Jewish law in 14 books, which is called Hayada Chazaka. He wrote the book in a beautiful Mishnayic Hebrew, and he summarized all of Jewish law up to his time in the 12th century. And the next stage in the development of Jewish law was the Shulchan Aruch, really written in the end by 2 rabbis, written in Sfat, around the year 1560, by Rabbi Yosef Caro, another Talmudic genius, born in Spain, but who spent most of his life, most of the important years of his life in Sfat, in Eretz Yisrael. And it contains the glosses, the comments and additions of Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who lived in Krakow, also in the 16th century. If you study any of these books, but especially the Babylonian Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch, to say that Jewish law has not developed is just plain silly. You look at the Mishnah, you see the discussions in the Talmud, and you see that within the Talmudic period itself, there are major developments on each subject under discussion. You look at the Shulchan Aruch, the standard page of the Shulchan Aruch has the Shulchan Aruch in the middle of the page, and it's surrounded by commentaries for a few hundred years. In those commentaries, you see the development of Jewish law. Those rabbis are arguing about what it says on the page, agreeing with Rabbi Yosef Caro, disagreeing with him, agreeing with Rabbi Moshe Isserles, disagreeing with him, bringing other opinions, saying we really follow this and not that. Rabbi Yosef Caro is right. Rabbi Moshe Isserles is right. They're both wrong. This is the way the Jewish law has developed, rabbinic law has developed for the past 2,000 years. And Rabbi, I think I'll just read one summary of this idea by Rabbi Yehuda Aryeh Modena, and you can find this booklet online. If you write in Google, David Golinkin Halakha for Our Time, you will find this booklet online on one of our websites. And on page 25, I quote Rabbi Yehuda Aryeh Modena, who died in 1648 in Italy. The words of the sages must be understood according to the time, the place, and the individual. For otherwise, we will be denying their words, just as the Karaites deny the oral Torah, since there is no end to the number of things forbidden by the sages, which became permitted as the time and place changed. So here we have a rabbi living in the 17th century in Italy, who is telling us that Jewish law developed over time, and that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of examples of this phenomenon.
Good, Rabbi. So if it's okay with you, let's just grab one or two examples, because then I have a couple of questions. Have you written down a couple of questions that I imagine people can ask you or can argue with you? But if you can tell us one or two questions or examples of this change, and maybe like radical change, and not just a small detail about, right? Because many people could argue, okay, like you have the Torah at the basis, and then a development in the Mishnah, a further development in the Talmud, and then a codification in the Mishneh Torah or the Shulchan Aruch with very small details. Okay, let's leave it. But I assume that there should be radical change in some form. Can you grab one or two or three small examples so we can understand?
Right. So in my standard lecture on the development of Jewish law, I have seven categories of change in Jewish law. I'll give you a few examples from the first categories. The first category is something that was well known and established in the Talmudic period, which totally disappeared from Jewish law. So the example I'm going to give is an example that the people listening to this podcast have probably never heard of. And that is Birkat Avilim, the blessing for mourners, which was recited right after a funeral. It's found in the Babylonian Talmud tractate Ketubot, folio 8b. You have there the text of the blessings, very beautiful blessings recited by the mourner and by the people comforting the mourners. It fills up.
It's in the same place that are the Sheva Brachot, right?
Right, exactly. The Sugya about Sheva Brachot.
You know, I remember something.
Good for you, Rabbi Romano. Okay, it's a beautiful blessings. By the time of the Geonim, which is between the years 500 and 1000, when the Jews lived mostly in Babylon, those blessings disappeared. Why? I have absolutely no idea. It's not the wording of the blessings. The wording of the blessings is absolutely beautiful. Every time I read or teach those blessings, I say, wow, the person who wrote these blessings was a liturgical genius. They disappeared. No Jew today observes Birkat Avilim, even though in the time of the Mishnah and the Talmud, this was standard practice by every Jew who ever lived. Okay, simply disappeared. And there are many other examples of things that disappeared over the course of time or changed entirely. For example, you may know the famous teaching in the Tractate of Ketubot, folio 77a. It says there that if a couple is married for 10 years and they don't have children, the husband can divorce his wife. That's what the Talmud says.
Because okay. of the mitzvah of procreation.
Because they can't fulfill the mitzvah of procreation. And of course, they didn't have fertility treatments and all the other things that we have today. You open up the Shulchan Aruch to Rabbi Moshe Isserles in Krakow in the 16th century, Evan Ezer, paragraph 1. He totally eliminates that halacha. It's not there anymore. It does not say that if they don't have children for 10 years, the husband divorces his wife. He or someone along the way, probably the Ribash, Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Sheshet, in Spain and North Africa in the 14th century, decided that we're no longer going to follow what it says in the Talmud. Perhaps they felt it was immoral. I don't know. And that statement that the husband divorces his wife if they don't have children for 10 years was not codified in the Shulchan Aruch by Rabbi Moshe Isserles. A third example, putting out a fire on Shabbat. The Mishnah makes it very clear in Tractate Shabbat, chapter 16. It says there.
And also it's today in Daf Yomi, in the Daf Yomi of today, Yomer, okay. It's exactly the same about Mapolet.
That's right. Yes. So yes. Shabbat, chapter 16, Mishnah 1, it says you may not put out a fire on Shabbat. And if you're going to save something from the fire, you can only save holy writings and food and garments. And if you look starting with the Orzarua, who lived in Vienna in the 13th century, he says that you can put out a fire on Shabbat and you can save just about everything. That's not what the Mishnah says, but that's what later Jewish law decided. And that too went into Rabbi Moshe Isserles' comments on the Shulchan Aruch, even though Rabbi Yosef Karo still sticks to the original law on the subject of putting out fires on Shabbat.
So category number one of the seven is just disappearing. Some laws,
right,
just
things that simply fell by the wayside or either partially or totally disappeared.
And Rabbi, can we do that like consciously or not today? For example, if I say there's some law about, I don't know, like something about women or something that I think is immoral today, that is from the time of the Talmud or something. Can I, we as a community say, okay, let's forget about that, or that's something that happened in the medieval times that we don't have the possibility to do that today?
Well,
to just ignore, right? Happen, because they are ignored.
Sometimes these changes happen by osmosis. They simply happen. The Jewish people decided that such a thing was no longer relevant. And sometimes it happened because a very famous rabbi decided that it was going to happen, or interpreted the law in such a way that it would happen. I would not recommend that we get up and stand up and say we're going to abolish such and such a law. There are rabbis who do that. They are usually reform rabbis, and they usually have very little basis for doing that. If you're going to do that, you need to quote some sort of texts or precedents normally in order to do that. The precedents can be from the Talmud, from the Babylonian Talmud, from the Talmud Yerushalmi, the so-called Palestinian Talmud, or from subsequent Jewish law. But simply to stand up and say, we're not going to do this because I don't like it, that is not the way Jewish law normally works. The only exception to that is if the rabbis of a generation make a takana, make a rabbinic enactment, operating as a group of rabbis to change something. And the most famous takanot are the takanot of Rabbeinu Gershom, the enactments of Rabbeinu Gershom, from who died around the year 1030 of the Common Era, of the early 11th century. He died right before Rashi was born. And Rabbeinu Gershom and his contemporaries made a series of takanot which influence us until today. For example, according to the Torah and the Talmud, a man is allowed to take more than one wife, right? Polygamy is permissible. And Rabbeinu Gershom decided that it's forbidden, together with his rabbinic colleagues.
100
He said from now on, a Jewish man can only take one wife. Originally, that takana was only adopted by Ashkenazim for 1,000 years. And in the middle of the 20th century, the chief rabbinate of Israel adopted that takana for Sfaradim as well, for Sephardic Jews as well. And that is why in the state of Israel today, polygamy is forbidden both to Ashkenazim and to Sfaradim. There are still some elderly Yemenite Jews who made Aliyah with their 3 or 4 wives, who still have 3 or 4 wives. They married those wives before they made Aliyah. They didn't do anything forbidden. They're following Talmudic law. Obviously, the Takana of Rabbeinu Gershom in Germany didn't make its way over to Yemen.
It's like Jacob taking the 2 wives. He didn't do anything wrong because the Torah was given afterwards.
That was the law at the time. But this is an example of a very famous group of rabbis getting together and deciding to change something in Jewish law for various reasons.
Before we go to the second category, this is just disappearing. I have a question. There's another, because usually we see takanot about forbidding something that at one moment was permissible. Do we find in Jewish history the other way around, permitting something, a takanot that permits something that in the past was forbidden?
Permitting something that was forbidden. I do not think that is one of my categories, but I'm sure I'll think of an example as we continue.
No, because that's more powerful, right? Because people usually say, and that's a claim of the author of the work, okay, you can do more gedarim, more like offenses to the Torah. That's
right. Well, I'll give you, as you know, I've written a number of books on the status of women in Jewish law in Hebrew and in English. And one of my responses says that it's permissible for women to have aliyot, to read from the Torah and have aliyot. Okay? That is not what it says in the main sentence on the subject in the Babylonian Talmud, which is found in Tractate Megillah, Folio 23a. It says there, Hakol olim liminyan shiva, all can go up to the seven to the Torah. Afilu isha v'afilu katan, or afilu katan v'afilu isha, even a minor or a woman. Aval amru chachamim isha lo tikra b'tzibur mipnei kvot tzibur. But the sages said a woman should not read in public because of the honor of the congregation. And what I show in my responsum is number one. So, and that was the normal law. I mean, there are some exceptions throughout Jewish history, but the normal law was that women do not have aliyah. What I show in my responsum is number one, that a tzibur, a congregation, has the right to relinquish its kavod and to say that this does not bother us. Right? It says you cannot do it because of kvod tzibur. The tzibur can say, Zeloma frialano, it doesn't bother us. It doesn't bother our honor. And number two, it's possible to do away with such a takana, with such an enactment of the rabbis, if conditions have changed. And in the time that brayta was written, let's say in the second century, boys and men were required to receive a Jewish education. Girls and women, in many cases, were not required to receive a Jewish education. And therefore, it was considered embarrassing that a woman would read from the Torah, because it meant that there were not seven men who knew how to read from the Torah. You have to know that then each person who had an aliyah read their own aliyah. The aliyot were very short. Okay, if a woman's reading in public, it means they could not find seven men who knew how to read. That is against kvod tzibur. That embarrasses the congregation. But now that Jewish men and women and Jewish boys and girls receive the same education, even among the ultra-Orthodox, the original reason for that takana has disappeared. And many rabbis say that if the original reason for forbidding something disappears, you no longer have to do that thing, right? So there is no longer embarrassment to the congregation because the boys and the girls and the men and the women received the same Jewish education. There is no reason why a man would be embarrassed by a woman reading from the Torah. So for those two reasons, I and many other modern rabbis, including some Orthodox rabbis, have said that it's permissible for women to read from the Torah in public, right? So this is permitting something that was previously forbidden. With your permission—
Let's go category number two.
Category number two. Category number two is a steady watering down of something it says in the Talmud. It's not that the thing disappeared. It's not that the thing was changed entirely. It's that the original prohibition over the course of many hundreds of years was watered down. And I'll give you two examples. Any Jew living in the diaspora today, whether in Argentina or the United States or Europe, knows what a Shabbos Goy is. A Shabbos Goy is that you ask the non-Jewish worker to turn on the lights in the synagogue on Shabbat, or do other things that are normally prohibited on Shabbat. And it's a well-known feature of Jewish life, and you even pay the guy to do it. A Shabbos Goy. Well, there's only one problem. A Shabbos Goy is absolutely forbidden both by the Mishnah and the Talmud. You are not allowed to tell a non-Jew to do something that is forbidden for you to do on Shabbat. And yet Jews have been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years. So Professor Yaakov Katz, I'll pull his book off the shelf here. Professor Yaakov Katz, Jacob Katz, who was a very famous historian of the halakha, right? He wasn't a halachist, he was an historian of the halakha. He wrote about the halakha in a sociological fashion, showing you the way the Jewish law developed over hundreds of years. And I had the privilege of knowing him. He passed away around 15, 20 years ago. I used to see him in the National Library where I just was this afternoon here in Jerusalem, a very old man stooped over who was one of these Talmudic geniuses who had grown up in Hungary and knew everything. So Yaakov Katz devoted an entire book to this subject. In Hebrew, it's called Goy Shel Shabbat. You can also read it in English. In English, it's called the Shabbos Goy. And he shows you, using hundreds of responsa and passages of halakha, this is the way he puts it. The more Jews were strict about Sabbath observance, the more they were lenient about the Shabbos Goy. In other words, they needed a shastom, they needed a safety valve. Since over the course of time, Jews became very strict in their observance of Shabbat, they needed a way around the restrictions of Shabbat. And the way that they chose sociologically was to use the Shabbos goy. Is that Shabbos goy in keeping with the teachings of the Mishnah? Absolutely not. But over the course of the development of Jewish law, the attitude towards the Shabbos goy became very lenient in order to solve the problem of Shabbos restrictions, which became very strict. And what he calls, what Jacob Katz calls this, is instinct harituali shel ha'am ha'yudi, the ritual instinct of the Jewish people. In other words, the Jewish people wanted to observe the Shabbos, but they had certain things that needed to be done. And since they couldn't do them themselves on Shabbat, they found the solution of the Shabbos goy to do it for them. And in every shtetl in Eastern Europe, there was at least one Shabbos goy who did the dirty work of the Jews. And today, throughout the diaspora, every synagogue, almost every synagogue, has a Shabbos goy who does
those things. Why you emphasize in the diaspora and not in the state of Israel? There's any reason?
Well, in Israel, there isn't a lot of use of Shabbos goys. I mean, it could be that the Israel Electric Corporation uses non-Jews on Shabbat because they need to keep the power system going for the entire state of Israel, as well as some other national institutions such as Mikorot, the national water carrier, and so on and so forth. But in Israel in general, you don't need a Shabbos goy because most things are closed on Shabbat. And in terms of Shabbat observance in synagogues, luckily, in the 20th century, somebody developed the Shabbos clock. And the Shabbos clock, the automatic timer on Shabbat, has solved many of those problems. The second, I'll just give you one more example about the hakala.
Watering.
Watering down of a restriction. As you all know, it says in the Ten Commandments, "Lo ta'aseh lecha pesah v'chol tmunah asher b'shamayim imah v'asher ba'aretz mitachat v'asher b'mayim mitachat la'aretz." You shall not
make pictures whatsoever. No,
any image, right? And any statue of something in the heavens above and something in the earth below. Ten Commandments is very clear on the subject, both in Shmot chapter 20 and in Dvarim chapter 5. Well, if you go into any synagogue in the world today, you will find statues, you will find mosaics, you will find stained glass windows in the synagogue. You will see that everything in that original commandment no longer, just about everything no longer exists. Okay, and not only that, people will give $1 million to sponsor a stained glass window in the synagogue.
And if you uncover one of the synagogues of the Tiberian, like in the third, fourth century, you will find like Eliot over there.
That's right. There are over 130 ancient synagogues discovered in the land of Israel from the Talmudic period. And many of them have mosaics with images, even images of Greek gods, such as Helios. And the question is, what happened? Why did the Jews decide to water down this commandment? And this was discussed already by Professor Ephraim Orbach in a famous article in 1959. And it was discussed at length by Professor Goodenough in his 10-volume work on Jewish symbols in the Greco-Roman period. And it's discussed by archaeologists and historians for the past at least 60 years. And the answer is hidden in a passage about Rabbi Yochanan, which is found in the Talmud Yerushalmi. And Rabbi Yochanan, who died in the year 279, he says there that in our day, most people no longer worship idols. And there lies the answer to the question. In other words, you need to limit images if you're fighting against religions which worship images. As Christianity became more widespread and paganism died out in the land of Israel and many other countries, Islam certainly does not worship idols. And even Christianity, you can argue what those statues of Jesus are. Are they really worshiping them? Probably not. In other words, idol worship is something, the entire system of idol worship, which was so prevalent in the time of the Bible, and so prevalent in the time of the Mishnah in the second century, already by the third century is starting to disappear. And Rabbi Yochanan says, we're no longer afraid of images. And that is what happened, that over the course of hundreds of years, the prohibitions against images in the synagogue became relaxed, and many, many famous rabbis said that it's permissible to have paintings, mosaics, and so on in the synagogue, because people no longer worship idols, and we're not afraid that the people sitting there in the synagogue think that they're bowing down to a picture of Moses or some other picture that is found in the synagogue.
Beautiful. So that's reason number two.
That is the second thing where there is constant leniency in a Talmudic prohibition. I want to give you a third category, which is similar, but not exactly the same. That category was leniency, the Shabbos Goy and the art. The third category is a narrowing of a law. There's a law says X, and the law became narrowed over the course of time.
It's very Talmudic, right? In that way, when you read the Talmud, it's like there was a general clause in the Mishnah, and then some rabbi in the Talmud says, okay, it's not for every case and every scenario, it's just for this little aspect. So you open a broad area of permission.
Right. So I'll give you two examples. One you might have heard of, the other you might not have heard of. The first example is Nesiat Kapayim, that the Kohanim are supposed to bless the people. If you like Star Trek like me, you know that Mr. Spock, who grew up in a synagogue in New York, he copied what the Kohanim did. And originally, by the way, the Kohanim did not cover their hands with a talis, which is why people were afraid to look at their hands. Once they covered their hands with a talis, there's no problem looking. You're looking at a talis. Okay? But even the most Orthodox Jew in the diaspora, the Kohanim only blessed the people on Musaf, on Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, and Musaf and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Ne'ilah and Yom Kippur. And the rest of the year, they don't bless the people. Well, that's really odd, because according to the Mishnah and the Talmud and all of classic rabbinic law, the Kohanim are required to bless the Jewish people every morning in the Shachrit service. And if you come to Israel and you go into any synagogue in Jerusalem on a weekday morning, you will see that the Kohanim are doing Birkat Kohanim. And outside of Jerusalem, it varies. Like in Haifa, they might only do it on every Shabbat. There are various customs, but certainly in Jerusalem, the Kohanim bless the people every single day of the year. Well, guys, that's the halacha. It says in the Talmud that a Kohen who does not bless the people every day, over al shalosh mitzvot taseh, is transgressing three positive commandments. Well, you open up the Shulchan Aruch to the laws of Birkat Kohanim. I'm not going to look for the exact passage. It's an Orach Chaim Kuf Chafchet Mem Dalet. Actually, I could open up. And what does Rabbi Moshe Isserles say? Noagu b'chom dinot elu she'en nosim kapayim ela b'yom tov. Mishum she'az shruyim b'simchat yom tov. The custom, this is writing in Poland in the 16th century, Rabbi Moshe Isserles said, the custom in all these nations and all these countries is that the Kohanim only bless the people on Yom Tov, which is the three pilgrim festivals, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because then they are shruyim, they are inside.
They were really happy. They were very happy in Nepal.
There's only one problem.
The rest of the year.
There's only one problem. It doesn't say anywhere that Kohanim have to be happy when they bless the people. This is a made-up explanation. At some time, beginning in the 13th century, the Hasidei Ashkenaz, the pious rabbis of Ashkenaz of Germany, decided that Birkat Kohanim could only be done on the pilgrim festivals, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Absolutely in contradiction to Talmudic law. And that's what stuck. There are a few exceptions. The Jews of Persia continue to do Birkat Kohanim every day. The Jews of Egypt continue to do Birkat Kohanim every day. And I think that the Jews of Yemen also continue to do Birkat Kohanim every day. In other words, they simply follow the Talmudic law. But in most of the Jewish world, simsimu, they shrunk the Talmudic law, and the Kohanim ended up only blessing the people five times a year. So this is a very interesting example, and there are many others, of tzimtzum, of narrowing an ancient rabbinic law where it is done much less or much different than it was originally intended. A fourth category is bifurcation, where the law split into different streams, which could be Ashkenazic and Sephardic, or it could be other streams. I'll give two examples, one of which I already mentioned, which are very famous regarding marriage and divorce. The first is bigamy. Starting in the 11th century, the Ashkenazim, you're only allowed to marry one wife. The Sfaradim continued to marry more than one wife until the year 1949. Okay, when the rabbis, chief rabbis of Israel, said that Sfaradim must also observe this takana. The other famous example is Yibum and Chalitza, which in English is called a levirate at marriage, or Chalitza, I don't think there is an English translation, which is that if Reuven is married to Sarah and Reuven dies without any children, Sarah is supposed to marry Reuven's brother Shimon. That's called Yibum. And if he does not wish to marry Sarah, they do a ceremony called Chalitza, removing the shoe and spitting. It's found in the Torah, which means that the brother will not marry the sister. Okay? The Ashkenazim decided that we no longer perform Yibum. Shimon, the brother, may not marry Sarah. You have to do Chalitza. The Sfaradim continued to do Yibum until the 20th century. Okay, that the brother could marry the widow of the brother who died.
That's the case of my great-grandfather from Syria. He has his first wife, okay? But the other way around, no? It's not Yibum by itself, but something I assume that a rabbi will ask you the law, but his wife died, so he married her sister. That's like Yibum, okay. The other way around.
Well, that's a different law, but okay.
Yes.
Okay. So these are two very famous examples. The Ashkenazim did X and the Sfaradim did Y. But I want to give you one more example, which touches on the life of every Jew who observes kashrut, the laws of kashrut in the world. How long do you wait between eating meat and milk? Well, you ask any Jew, you'll get a different answer, right?
6 hours, 3 hours, 72 minutes.
Three hours, 72 minutes, 6 hours, 1 hour. Where does that come from? It all stems from the same sugya, the same passage in the Talmud, which is Chulin Kuf Hei Amud Aleph, folio 105a. It says there that after eating meat and you want to eat milk, you have to wait ad lesudeta achrita, until another meal. It doesn't say how long. It says until another meal. And one of the opinions there is that you have to wait 24 hours. But the opinion that was accepted was until another meal. Well, Chaverim, how long do you wait between one meal and another? That's something very subjective. It could be an hour. It could be 3 hours. It could be 6 hours. So you have there a bifurcation of Jewish law. In the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeia, paragraph 89, Rabbi Yosef Kara says you wait 6 hours. Rabbi Moshe Isserles says you wait an hour. The 3 hours does not appear in the Shulchan Aruch. I have no idea where it comes from. I think it was a compromise between A and B. But you ended up with all this.
At 9 and then lunch at 12. So this is the other two, that, right? So
you ended up with these different customs of bifurcation of different ways of observing kashrut, because the original Talmudic passage does not tell you an amount of time. Remember, in the time of the Talmud, they didn't have clocks and they didn't have watches. So they couldn't say, wait an hour. There was no such thing. People didn't have a timepiece with the same hour, right? They said, l'sudeta achrita, until the next meal. So everybody defined sudeta achrita in a different way. The fifth category is very interesting, which is changes due to the fact that Jews moved from place to place and from country to country. And here Jewish law was influenced by dress, by the way people dressed, by the physical environment, such as the climate, the geography, the food, and society. And there are hundreds of examples of these types of changes. And this gives me a chance to mention two books. This book is very hard to find. It took me years to find it. Adjustment of Law to Life in Rabbinic Literature by Rabbi Dr. Solomon Zucro. You might be able to find it somewhere online. It was published in Boston in 1928. And another book, which is easy to buy, by Rabbi Dr. Louis Jacobs, one of my role models. Rabbi Dr. Louis Jacobs was the founder of the Masorti movement in England, originally an Orthodox rabbi who later became a conservative rabbi. He was the main contender to be the chief rabbi of England, but as a result of publishing his book, We Have Reason to Believe, in the late 1950s, they decided he was not worthy of being the chief rabbi of England because his approach to Jewish law was non-fundamentalist. That's the subject of another lecture. He published at least 24 books. This is one of them. I have most of them. This is called A Tree of Life, subtitle, Diversity, Flexibility, and Creativity in Jewish Law. And he divides his examples into the influence of philosophy, the influence of Kabbalah, the influence of Hasidism, responses to the Gentile world, responses to changed conditions and social needs, new inventions, halakha and good manners, halakha and psychology, halakha and the customs of the people, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, he gives hundreds of examples of changes in Jewish law for all these different reasons. Some of my examples I got from his book, some of my examples I got from my own studying, but I'd like to give you a few categories of types of changes. For example, how did the way we dress influence Jewish law? Well, I'm wearing a kippah. Rabbi Romano's wearing a kippah. Whenever I give a lecture on this subject, I call it to beanie or not to beanie. That is the question. Right? Do you wear a beanie or not? Do you wear a kippah or not? Jews have been arguing about head covering for men since the time of the Mishnah. One of the main reasons they were arguing was because they lived in different countries and there were different customs, what was considered respectful to God and what was considered disrespectful. I'll just give you two examples. In the time of the Talmud in the land of Israel, they used to recite the Shema with their heads uncovered. How do we know this? Because we are told so explicitly in Vayikra Rabbah, in the Midrash on the book of Leviticus. In Babel, it was considered a sign of respect to cover your head when reciting blessings, when eating, and so on and so forth. So the passages in the Babylonian Talmud on the subject of head covering are very much in favor of head covering. And the passage in the Palestinian sources at the same period of time do not require you to cover your head when you pray. Same thing happened in the Middle Ages. The Jews of Germany used to cover their heads. That was a sign of respect. The Jews of France used to daven, if you'll excuse the anachronism, they didn't daven in France. They used to daven with their heads uncovered. How do we know this? Because the German rabbis criticized them. Rabbi Yitzchak Or Zarua says in Vienna, in the middle of the 13th century, Rabotenu shebetzorfat olim la Torah begilui rosh. Our rabbis in France go up to the Torah with their heads uncovered, and he says, I don't understand this. And then, of course, he tries to find a source, which he finds, which justifies that behavior. In other words, the subject of covering or uncovering the head was very much influenced by where the Jews lived, what was a sign of respect, and what was a sign of disrespect. So there is dress. Second example, climate. How does climate influence halakha? So let's go to the laws of Shabbat. Obviously, according to a halakha that I already quoted, you're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to light a fire for you on Shabbat, right? Except if someone is sick. Okay. So the Jews are in Ashkenaz. I don't know if you've ever been in Germany or in Poland in the winter, but I can assure you it's very, very cold, or at least before climate change. 25 years ago, I went to Poland to search for my roots of my family. I also went to Auschwitz. I was there in the month of March. It was absolutely freezing. I was wearing a winter coat and I was cold the entire time that I was there. This was in the month of March. So you can imagine what it's like in December or January. So what did the rabbis of Germany do? The Mordechai, who lived in Germany in the 13th century, developed a new halachic concept. What is the halachic concept? Hakol cholim etzel akor. That when it comes to being cold on Shabbat, everybody is considered sick.
And so for that reason, you can ask a goy to light the
right.
fire.
In other words, if your fire goes out on Shabbat, you have a choice of freezing to death on Shabbat or asking a goy to light the fire. You ask the non-Jew to light the fire because hakol cholim etzel akor. Everyone is considered sick when it comes to cold and hot. So this was a concept that he invented, but he understood that in the conditions of Germany, if he did not invent this concept, people would die of the cold in the middle of the winter if their fire went out on Shabbat.
Because he says, you don't have to be sick to do it. It's just like you are all considered sick milechatchila from the beginning.
Right. In other words, not only is a sick person allowed to ask a non-Jew to light a fire on Shabbat, but any Jew is allowed to ask a non-Jew to light a fire on Shabbat in Germany in the 13th century. The Mordechai would not have said the same thing about Iraq or Yemen. He was talking about his local conditions due to the local climate. And the same thing happened with sleeping in a sukkah. Anybody who studies the tractate of sukkah knows that you are required to dwell in the sukkah for 7 days or 8 days in the diaspora, and you're required to sleep there. And then the Jews arrive in all these cold countries, and what are they going to do? Die of the cold? So in the halachic literature, they rely on the concept found in the tractate of sukkah that you do not have to sleep in the sukkah because of tsa'ar, because of suffering. And the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Shulchan Aruch in the 16th century, again, I was in Krakow in March. I can imagine what it was like in December or January. You can still see Rabbi Moshe Isserles' grave in Krakow. I went to see his grave.
Next to the synagogue, right?
What? Right, it's next to the synagogue. And he says that because of the cold, you do not have to sleep in the sukkah. Right? This is something that the rabbis of the Mishnah could not have anticipated. The land of Israel in the second century is not Poland in the 16th century. So because of the claim, because of the change in climate, the rabbis in Poland and Germany were very lenient on these issues.
And the Rabbi Golinki, I know that you have two more categories. I know that in 15 minutes we have to end. And I have a couple of questions. So
okay,
maybe you can go summary the last two categories. And then I have 5 more minutes to ask you some questions.
Okay. So the last two categories are changes in Jewish law because of social changes or economic changes. And I'll give you one very simple example that you all know. Most Jews in the world light candles on Hanukkah, right? In Israel, the statistics, the two most observed rituals in Israel are the Seder on Pesach and lighting candles on Hanukkah. Same thing in the diaspora, okay? I recently studied the passage in the Tractate of Shabbat about Hanukkah with my students in the Talmud. It says there that you have to put your Hanukkah lamp, your Hanukkiah, what it's called today, outside your house facing the street. Okay, well, if you do a survey of Jews throughout Jewish history, especially in the diaspora, and try and figure out how many of them actually did what it says in the Talmud, you'll find that most of them didn't do that. Where did they light their candles? Inside the house, on the table. Okay, why? Because society had changed. They moved to different places. They no longer lived in Jewish neighborhoods or Jewish cities. They no longer lived in courtyards the way they were shaped in the Talmudic period. Slowly but surely, the Chanukiah ended up being inside your house and not facing the street for Pirsume Nisa in order to advertise the miracle of Hanukkah. So here, a change in society, a change in the way that Jews live. Another famous example if you go to Rabbi Romana's synagogue or any synagogue in the Jewish world on a weekday or Shabbat, you'll see that the service starts with Birchot HaShachar, with the early morning blessings, right? Asher natan asech vivina, shelo asani this, or shasani that, right? The famous blessings at the beginning, those are called the early morning blessings. If you look in the Talmud, in the tractate of Brachot, folio 60b, it says there very explicitly that those blessings are recited at home when you wake up in the morning. They were never recited in the synagogue in the Talmudic period. Why do we recite them in the synagogue? The Geonim decided that most Jews were not learned enough to recite these blessings at home. We have to do it in a synagogue because if you tell Jews to do it at home, they ain't going to do it. So they moved Birchot HaShachar, the early morning blessings, to the synagogue. And that is our custom until today because of a change in society and a change in Jewish knowledge. The last two categories are, first of all, the influence of Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism on Jewish law. Kabbalah is something that's not really found in the Talmud in a very minor fashion. It's not really there. It's found in the Zohar, which was written in Spain in the 13th century. It's found in many other books of Jewish mysticism. And over the course of time, Kabbalah had a tremendous effect on Jewish law. And I'm only going to give you one example. I'll give you an example you all know. It wasn't the example I was going to give you, but I'll give you one you all know. How long do we recite Kaddish when a parent passes away? You ask most Jews in the world. 11 months, right? Is that the original custom? Absolutely not. The original custom
is 30 days, right?
You recite for 12 months. You recite the Kaddish for the full year. Okay? Why do we recite Kaddish for 11 months and not for 12 months? Because there's a passage in the Talmud which says that the judgment of the wicked in Gehinnom, in hell, is 12 months. If you recite Kaddish for 12 months, it means you think your parent was wicked. And therefore, we recite Kaddish for 11 months. In other words, this belief in hell, which is basically a mystic belief, this belief in hell led to a change in Jewish law, which is that you recite Kaddish for 11 months and not 12 months. The original custom from the time of Rashi, more or less, is that you recite Kaddish for 12 months when your parent passes away. And if you write in Google, David Golinkin, Kaddish, 12 months, you'll find my response, which brings all the sources on the subject. The last category is new laws and new customs. In theory, Jewish law is based on the Mishnah and the Talmud. And yet there are hundreds of things that we do as Jews that are not found in the Mishnah or the Talmud. They developed at a later period of Jewish history. And I'm just going to name them. I'm not going to give you the sources. These are things you all know, right? Every Jew, every Ashkenazic Jew knows that on the three pilgrim festivals, etc., we recite Yizkor, right? Is Yizkor mentioned in the Mishnah and Talmud? No. It started in Ashkenaz in the 12th or 13th century. Simchas Torah, the festival of rejoicing with the Torah on the so-called last day of Sukkot, the ninth day of Sukkot, was developed in the Gaonic period. Didn't exist in the Mishnah and the Talmud. Kaddish Yatom that I just mentioned, started in France and Germany in the 11th century. Kitniot, not eating rice and legumes on Pesach. Not only is that not Talmudic law, it's against Talmudic law. Talmudic law rules very clearly that you're allowed to eat rice and legumes on Pesach. This is a custom that started in France in the 13th century.
And also, Rabbi, saying the blessings, right, over the candles. On Shabbat.
The Shabbat candle. Well, the Shabbat candles started earlier. Shabbat candles are already found.
No, but the blessing. But the blessing, I mean. The blessing.
Okay, that I don't know when the blessing started, but the lighting candles on Shabbat is already found in the Mishnah, tractate of Shabbat, chapter 2.
But I believe I was taught by Professor Benovitz that it's the only outside blessing after the Talmudic time that it was developed. The blessings over the candle.
Very interesting. Could be.
So
could
that's be.
And I'll give you three last examples from Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. These are the customs we all know and love. Tashlich, On Rosh Hashanah, we throw our sins into the water, a river, or the ocean. First mentioned by Rabbi Yaakov Molin the Maharil, who died in the year 1427. Tashlich did not exist before that period in time. Slichot, the penitential prayers before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, is from the time of the Geonim from Babylon. And blowing the shofar during the month of Elul is from the period of the Geonim, not mentioned in any place in Talmudic literature. So these are developments in Jewish law which are post-Talmudic, in the time of the Geonim, in the time of the Rishonim, the medieval rabbis, and even in the time of the Achronim, of the later rabbis. So we see here that halakha is a constantly developing process, and that is its beauty. And I think that shows that it's alive and that we're alive. And if the halakha were static, it would mean that it was boring, that it was dead, and it doesn't reflect the lives of a living Jewish people.
Beautiful, Rabbi, beautiful. We have like 5 more minutes and we are done. I have a couple of questions for you, if it's okay with you, like quick, like Q&A. First of all, there's a category that you didn't mention. What about changing laws or changing the halakha or reviewing the halakha because of ideological or moral reasons? That's also being seen, or it's a possibility or no?
In my booklet, Halakha for Our Time, I gave examples of changes in Jewish law, all from the Talmudic period, not from the medieval period. And one of my categories is changes due to moral sensitivity. And I'll give you one very famous example that you all know, even though you don't know that you know this example. And that is that Jews are buried in tachrichim, which are simple white garments. Why are Jews buried in tachrichim? The Talmud tells us in the Tractate of Moed Katan that in former times, the expense of the burial garments was more difficult for a man's relatives than his death, so that the dead man's relatives abandoned him and fled. In other words, they couldn't afford the fancy garments that they used to use to dress the dead. So people who were poor would abandon their relatives and not bury them. They didn't know what to do. You're supposed to dress them in all these fancy clothes, but I can't pay for the fancy clothes. Rabbi Gamliel made a takana. This is Rabbi Gamliel the elder, apparently, who died before the destruction of the Second Temple. He said, I am going to be buried in simple white tachrichim. Since then, Jews are buried in simple white tachrichim for moral reasons, for ethical reasons, so that all Jews are buried in an egalitarian fashion. So the rich are not buried one way and the poor another. We're all buried in the same way for reasons of ethics.
That's connected with the next question. It's very fast because I know you need to go, but it's very important for me. The other question is, okay, many of the examples you said, okay, this was a takana for Rabban Gamliel, okay, or the elder rabbi. But many people say, okay, they were able to do, okay? We today, because of the Yeridat HaDorot, we are not able now to change anything.
Okay.
That's a claim.
Well, first of all, you don't need to make a takana to make changes in Jewish law. I gave before the example of Aliyot for women. In the responsa, if we study the sources carefully, we can frequently justify a change or a development in Jewish law using the traditional rabbinic sources. You don't need 10 rabbis or 100 rabbis to make a takana. The reason I'm opposed to takanot is not because of Yeridat HaDorot. I don't think it's because our generation is less worthy than previous generations. Our problem is very different. Our problem is that most Jews in the world today do not observe Jewish law. In the time of Rabbeinu Gershom, let's say in the 10th century, so he makes a takana, the 11th century, he makes a takana about bigamy, okay? Most of the Jews that he was making the takana for observed Jewish law, right? They didn't have to be scholars, they didn't have to be Talmidei Chachamim, but they observed Jewish law. They prayed every day, they kept kosher, they observed the laws of Torah HaMishpacha, the women went to the mikveh. In other words, you have a group of rabbis legislating for a group of Jews who observe Jewish law. I think it would be very strange today for a group of rabbis to legislate for most of the Jews in the world who don't observe Jewish law. In other words, if you want to make an enactment, you have to make an enactment for a group of people who consider what you are doing binding. But if what you are doing is not binding to begin with, who are you legislating for, right? In other words, in any state in the world today, you can change the speed limit. That's because most people understand that you need a speed limit, you need traffic laws, and if we don't have a speed limit, we'll all kill each other. The problem is that today, most Jews in the world don't have a speed limit. They don't observe halakha. They don't observe Jewish law. So to say, I'm going to allow them to do X, well, they're doing X anyway, because they don't give a hoot about Jewish law. So first, let's convince all Jews to observe Jewish law. Then we'll talk about takanot. That's my opinion.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And now, Q&A that we do with all our interviews. And with this, we close. Very rapid answers. Okay, Rabbi? Number one, what's your favorite passage from the Torah?
My favorite passage from the Torah?
Yes.
You got me. There are too many.
Or a pasuk that you love.
Kabed et avicha ve et imecha. Honor your father and your mother. It's an extremely important principle until today.
Your most beloved holiday of the Jewish year.
Most beloved holiday of the Jewish year. It's a toss-up between, Pesach, the Seder.
Beautiful. Another period of Jewish history that you would like to revive on?
Oh, that I would like to visit?
Yes.
The time of the Mishnah. I would love to go back in a time machine and spend a year or two in the time of the Mishnah. It's not going to happen, but if you want to pretend you were there, you should read the book As a Driven Leaf by Rabbi Milton Steinberg, which exists in Spanish. What's it called in Spanish?
Como una hoja al viento.
I highly recommend that every Jew read As a Driven Leaf. You will feel as if you lived in the time of the Mishnah.
And then a person in Jewish history that you would like to meet?
A period in Jewish history?
No, a person. Someone who died.
Oh, a person. Yeah.
That you would like to have a conversation, a coffee with.
That's a tough one. Maimonides, the Rambam.
That's good, Rabbi. And last but not least, and then we will leave you with this. One important message from Judaism to the world, not only Jews, but to the world. What could it be? Like a message, an idea of the Jewish people to the world.
Well, the Christians call it the Golden Rule. Of course, it's from Hillel in Shabbat Folio 31a. What is hateful to you, do not do to others. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. That applies to every person in the world.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. It was a pleasure. It was an honor.
So thank you, Rabbi Romano. We crammed in about 2,000 years in an hour.
That's good enough.
Read my response in English and Hebrew and continue to learn about Jewish law. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Nos vemos todos en un próximo episodio de Pieles. Chau.